Hello, hello, good afternoon. Yes, 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 good evening. Today we are going to discuss a few things. We're going to discuss your guys' favorite topic, row operations, otherwise known as the Gosh Jordan elimination method. So we're going to discuss a bit about that. We're also going to talk about some important mathematical events in history, specifically pertaining to Sir Isaac Newton, who was born in 1643. And he contributed so much to not only math, but physics, astronomy, philosophy, English. He was a very well-rounded and well-known scientist and mathematician. And then finally, we're going to discuss the Fibonacci sequence, whatever that is, right? Yeah, we're going to talk about the Fibonacci sequence, what that entails, how the Fibonacci sequence models nature, etc., etc. So let's just jump right into it. All right, so the first thing we're going to discuss is the Gauss-Jordan elimination method, or row operations. So what is row operations? What is the Gauss-Jordan elimination method? It's basically an algorithm that can be used to solve systems of linear equations and to find the inverse of any invertible matrix. So it involves matrices, and matrices are basically sets of numbers within brackets, and they go across rows. So the Gauss-Jordan elimination, it relies upon three main elementary row operation rules. So the first rule is to swap the positions of two of the rows. So this is also called row switching. So this is the first operation. So for instance, if you're given a matrix such as, and this is just going across 0, 0, 1, 3. So this is a matrix. I'd say this is a 4x3 matrix. 0, 0, 1, 3, 1, 2, 3, 5, 0, 1, -2, 4. So that's a matrix, right? So if you were to switch the rows, you can switch the rows around to put the matrix into a nicer row arrangement, like 1, 2, 3, 5, 0, 1, -2, 4, 0, 0, 1, 3. So what we did there, we simply just switched the last row. We switched the last row and the first row. All right. So the second elementary row operation rule, if you will, is to multiply one of the rows by a non-zero scalar. So what does that even mean? So the second operation is row multiplication. So for instance, if you're given a matrix, and again, this is going across, this is another 4x3 matrix. It's -1, 0, 0, 3, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 0, -2, 4. So you can multiply the first row by -1 to get a positive leading value in the first row. So 1, 0, 0, -3 would be the first row. Second row would be 0, 1, 0, 2. And the third row would be 0, 0, -2, 4. All right. Now, to add on to this, you can also have a set of rules for these row operations. So you can kind of make up your own rules as you go along. The purpose is to get an identity matrix. So the main idea is to get ones going down a diagonal. This is also specifically useful for 3x3 matrices. Ones going down a diagonal and zeros all around. So, okay. So you have row multiplication, and it's like -1, 0, 0, 3, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 0, -2, 4. So that's a 4x3 matrices. If you say a rule like, so -1, R1, that's the rule. So basically you would multiply the first row by -1, and you just get 1, 0, 0, -3, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 0, -2, 4. So yeah, you can kind of, you know, have a little bit of flexibility here with making up the rules, but the main idea is to get the same identity matrix at the end, so that ones are going down a diagonal and zeros are all around. The third rule of thumb here, the third row of operations would be to add or subtract the scalar multiple of one row to another row. So basically, you can do more than one row multiplication within the same step. You can have, so for example, I said before, you can do you multiply the first row by negative one, that'd be the rule, negative one, R1. You can also, in the same step, multiply the last row by negative half. So you'd be doing the last row, 0, 0, negative 2, 4, by negative half, to get your new third row, which would be 0, 0, 1, negative 2. You have a lot of flexibility here. You can actually have a lot of fun with this. Although this can also be very, very tedious if you kind of don't really have the right rules. It can be very tedious. Let's just go through some more examples here. So you have a matrix row of operations. And remember how I said you can switch any of the two rows, and that was kind of like the first rule, the swapping the two rows. So if you have a row operation that says 2, 5, 3, 3, 4, 6, that 2, 5, 3 is on top, and then 3, 4, 6 is on the bottom. You can switch the rows so that it's 3, 4, 6, 2, 5, 3. Secondly, you can multiply a row by a non-zero constant, which was the second rule, row multiplication. So you could do, if you have a 3 by 2 matrix, 2, 5, 3 on the top and 3, 4, 6 for the second row, you can multiply the first row by 3 times 2, 3 times 5, 3 times 3. And then row 1 becomes 3 times itself. So it would be 3 times 2, 3 times 5, 3 times 3. And then the third rule of thumb, adding one row to another. Adding or subtracting, basically. So row 2 becomes the sum of rows 2 and 1. So if you have 2, 5, 3, and then at the bottom you have 3, 4, 6. The top row would be 2, 5, 3. And then you can add to the bottom row, plus 2, plus 5, plus 3. Right, so it's better to do some examples on your own to get the hang of things. So if we do run problem, okay, so we're going to perform the row of operations for R1 interchanging with R2. So you have a 3 by 3 matrices. It says 4, 8, 3, first row. 2, 4, 5, second row. 7, 1, 2, third row. So for interchanging rows 1 and 2, we're just switching rows 1 and 2 simply. So now the new matrices is 2, 4, 5, 4, 8, 3, 7, 1, 2. Very easy. Sometimes you'll see the following notation used to indicate this change. You'll see, it'll say R1, double arrow, R2. So now you can kind of get the hang of things. Another example we can do, so perform row operation 3R2 going to R2. So the matrix is 6, 6, 1, 2, 3, 0, 4, 5, 9. It's a 3 by 3 matrices. So the rule is 3R2. So we're multiplying the second row, and then that's going to be replaced with the new second row. We're multiplying the second row by 3. So it's just 2 times 3, 3 times 3, 0 times 3. And then the new matrices becomes 6, 6, 1, 6, 9, 0, 4, 5, 9. So it's pretty easy. It's with practice comes perfect. I know I struggled with this topic because I could get the rules, but I just couldn't get the last number. but with practice makes perfect. It can actually be pretty fun if you're into numbers and rules. It's a very interesting topic, actually. So as we move on to our next subject. All right, we're going to take a quick break. All right. We are back from our mini break. So we're going to talk about some history now. We're going to talk about some great moments in mathematical history and how they provided significant insights into mathematics, engineering, geometry. Oh, well, we're going to focus on math. So, well, I mean, there are many, many main and amazing mathematical events in history. It goes to all the way from numbers, the birth of numbers from 3,000 years ago when the Greeks started to look for rational explanations for natural phenomena and lay the foundations of geometry and arithmetic with leading figures like Pythagoras and Theano, the first female mathematician in history. We can go all the way back to even the world map and measuring the earth with the rod, the Greek mathematician whose name I cannot pronounce, Eratosthenes, was able to calculate the earth's diameter using a rod stuck in the ground, and the rule of three. Napoleon, in his insights with mathematics, his contribution to thermodynamics, also Newton, who we're going to focus on today, the famous mathematician. So we're gonna delve a little bit more into him. So in the 17th century in England, there was an expansion of the British Empire. And there were old universities like Oxford and Cambridge. They were producing many great scientists and mathematicians. But controversially, the greatest one of them all was Sir Isaac Newton, which I'm sure many of you have heard by now. So, physicist, mathematician, astronomer, natural philosopher, alchemist, and theologian, I didn't even know that was a word, Newton is considered by many to be one of the most influential men in human history. His 1687 publication called The Philosophy Naturalis Principia Mathematica, usually just called the Principia, it's considered to be among the most influential books in history of science, and it dominated the scientific view of the physical universe for the next three centuries. So, although largely synonymous in the minds of the general public today with gravity and the story of the apple tree, Newton remains a giant in the minds of mathematicians everywhere, on a par with all greats like Archimedes and Gauss. We just talked about the Gauss-Jordan method. And he greatly influenced the subsequent path of mathematical development. All right. So, during the time of the Great Plague, the young Newton developed a new theory of light. He discovered and quantified gravitation, theory of gravity, pioneered a revolutionary new approach to mathematics, infinitesimal calculus. His theory of calculus built on earlier work by his fellow Englishmen John Wallace and Isaac Barrow, as well as on work of such continental mathematicians as René Descartes, Pierre de Fermat, and a few other people. So unlike geometry of the Greeks, calculus allowed mathematicians and engineers to make some sense of the motion and dynamic change in the changing world around us, such as orbits of planets, the motion of fluids, etc. All right, so let's talk about a specific theory that Newton has, discovered. The initial problem Newton was confronting with the average slope of a curve was that it was easy enough to represent and calculate the average slope of a curve, for example, increasing speed of an object on a time-distance graph. The slope of a curve was constantly varying, and there was no method to give the exact slope at any one individual point on the curve. So, effectively, the slope of a tangent line to the curve at that point. So, the slope at a particular point on a curve can be approximated by taking the average slope, or rise over run, of even smaller segments of the curve. As the segment of the curve being considered approaches zero in size,
the calculation of the slope approaches closer and closer to the exact slope at a point. So if you have a curve and there's distance between points A, points B1, B2, and B3 becomes even smaller, the approximation of the slope of the curve at point A becomes more and more exact. The derivative of a curve gives a value for the slope as the distance between A and the other point becomes infinitely small, but not zero. All right, so without going into too much complicated detail, Newton, he calculated a derivative function, fx, which gives the slope at any point of a function. So you guys, when you're writing down fx and you're like, what does that even mean? Where has that come from? Thank Newton, y'all. This process of calculating the slope or derivative of a curve or function is called differential calculus or differentiation, or in Newton's terminology, the method of fluxions. He called the instantaneous rate of change at a particular point on a curve the fluxion. It's changing values of x and y, the fluence. So for instance, the derivative of a straight line of the type 4x equals 4x, it's just 4. The derivative of a squared function, fx equals x squared, equals 2x. The derivative of a cubic function, fx equals x cubed, is 3x squared, and so forth and so on. Generalizing the derivative of any power function, fx equals xr, is rx, r minus 1. So that's what he discovered, that the derivative of any power function, fx equals xr, is rx, r minus 1. Other derivative functions can be stated according to certain rules. For exponential and logarithmic functions, so that a derivative function can be stated for any curve without discontinuities. So, for example, the derivative of a curve, fx equals x4 minus 5x3 plus, let's throw in some trig, sin x squared would be fx equals 4x3 minus 15x squared plus 2x cos x squared. Guys, remember your sin cos? I know I used to have to try to remember, what's it called? Not algorithms. You know, when you memorize certain acronyms. Yes, I would memorize certain acronyms for sin cos, so that I know which one it would be in high school. Right, so having established the derivative function of a particular curve, it is then an easy matter to calculate the slope at any particular point on that curve just by inserting a value for x. All right, so let's talk about the method of fluence. So the opposite of differentiation is integration, or integral calculus, or in Newton's terminology, method of fluence. And together, differentiation and integration are two main operations of calculus. Newton's fundamental theorem of calculus states that differentiation and integration are inverse operations, so they are the inverse of each other. If a function is first integrated and then differentiated, or vice versa, the original function is retrieved. So the area under a curve can be approximated by summing the area of a number of rectangles or slabs drawn within it. The greater the number of rectangles used, the thinner the slabs, the more accurate the approximation. So the green area, well, if you were seeing the graph that I'm looking at, there's basically a graph and it just depicts the how to see the area under a curve. There's a bunch of green bars and there's yellow bars on top. And the green area is better approximation of that of the yellow integration. The green area below is a better approximation than the yellow, and the integration gives an area based on an infinite number of slabs, and so approaches the exact area. So integration approximates the area under a curve as the size of the samples approaches zero. So let's talk about under the curve. The integral of a curve can be thought of as the formula for calculating the area bounded by the curve and the x-axis between two defined boundaries. So, for example, on a graph of velocity against time, the area under the curve would represent the distance traveled. Essentially, integration is based on a limiting procedure which approximates the area of a curve curvilinear region by breaking it into infinite thin vertical slabs or columns. All right, I hope that's been enough of this theorem for you for Newton's little discovery of the average slope of a curve. We're going to go on a slight break again, and we're going to go jump into the Fibonacci sequence. All right, guys. So we're gonna end off our segment with explaining the Fibonacci sequence and how it relates to how it models nature. So the Fibonacci sequence has always attracted the attention of people, since, as well as having, you know, special mathematical properties, other numbers so ubiquitous as those of Fibonacci do not exist anywhere else in mathematics. They appear in geometry, algebra, number theory, many other fields of mathematics, and even nature. So, the life of Fibonacci. Leonardo Pisano, also called Fibonacci, Fibonacci stands for Phileas Bonacci, was born in Pisa around 1170. His father, Bonacci, was a wealthy Pisan merchant and representative of the merchants of the Republic of Pisa in the area of Bugia in Kabylia in modern northeastern Algeria. After 1192, took his son with him because he wanted Leonardo to become a merchant. So he got Leonardo into the study under the guidance of a Muslim teacher who guided him in learning calculation techniques, especially those concerning Indo-Arabic numbers, which had not yet been introduced in Europe. Fibonacci's education started in Bijaya and continued in Egypt, Syria, and Greece, places he visited with his father along trade routes before returning permanently to Pisa starting from 1200. So let's just skip the history for now, since we already had our history lesson, and let's just go straight into it with the Fibonacci sequence. So the Fibonacci sequence in nature. So Fibonacci sequence, it studies subsequently multiplied, and numerous and unexpected properties of the sequence were discovered. So observing the geometry of plants, flowers, or fruit, it's easy to recognize the presence of recurrent structures and forms. The Fibonacci sequence, for example, plays a vital role in phyllotaxis, which studies the arrangement of leaves, branches, flowers, or seeds in plants, with the main aim of highlighting the existence of regular patterns. So the various arrangements of natural elements following mathematical regularities. Darcy Thompson observed that the plant kingdom has a curious preference for particular numbers and for certain spiral geometries, and that these numbers and geometries are closely related. So we can easily find the numbers of the Fibonacci sequence in spirals formed by individual flowers in the composite inflorescences of daisies, sunflowers, cauliflowers, and broccoli. So I wish you could see this, but there's a picture of a sunflower, and it has individual flowers are arranged along curved lines which rotate clockwise and counterclockwise. It was Kepler who noted that on many types of trees, the leaves are aligned in a pattern that includes two Fibonacci numbers, starting from any leaf after 1, 2, 3, or 5 turns of the spiral. There is always a leaf aligned with the first, and depends on the species, this will be the second, the third, the fifth, the eighth, or 13th leaf. This is pretty cool. So, in another example in which it's possible to find the Fibonacci sequence in nature, it's given by numbers of petals of flowers. So, most flowers have like 3 petals, like lilies and irises, or 5, like parnassia and rose hips, or 8, like hosmia, 13, like some daisies, 21, like chicory, 34, 55, 89. These numbers are part of the famous Fibonacci sequence that was just described in the previous paragraph. So this is a pretty interesting theory that the Fibonacci sequence has to do with the arrangement of how it presents in flowers, and how it relates to kind of like geometry and like mathematical regularities. This is actually one of my first times hearing about it, so I actually learned something new besides just the semester, but the whole Fibonacci sequence in general is actually really, really interesting stuff. So if you guys want to go and research it yourself, learn something new today. All right. It's been a great time with you guys, but now I'm going to sign off. All right. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a good one and a happy holidays. All right. Out.